Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. And what a week to be doing that in. In this week's episode, I explore the arrival of Liz Truss and the legacy of Boris. And to do that, I am thrilled to say that I am joined today by the editor of Reaction, Maggie Pagano. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, Lucy. And what a week, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And how fluid it's been, because I was giving that introduction there and saying, oh, we're going to be talking about the legacy of Boris. And it almost feels like old news already. And it was only 2 days ago.
No, completely. And I was thinking this last night, Lucy. It's as though the Boris reign was a mirage, you know, a dream. But it's true, you know, when he left there with Carrie in that very pink dress, and then you saw the front bench yesterday at PMQs with this completely new cast of characters, sort of thought, well, hold on, Partygate, vaccine, you know, lockdown, what was all that about? Very bizarre feeling.
Yes, and I feel I ought to draw out my inner Jungian therapist here and talk about the nature of that dream and what it really said. They always say that the dream tells you more about the dreamer. And I think a lot of people, there were a lot of projections onto Boris, and there were a lot of issues around him that people wanted. They wanted to be angry with him, and they wanted to find fault, and they wanted to be disappointed. But I often used to wonder whether that told us more about him. What do you think of that?
Well, I would say the complete reverse. I always felt Boris was obviously this larger-than-life character as mayor, and we knew his flaws, and you know, being a journalist as well, one heard, you know, a lot of what he got up to at the Telegraph. And in fact, I was in the City office when he was in Brussels, and people were sort of, you know, joking about him then. And so we knew that this man was deeply flawed. You know, his whole marriage, his personal life was a bit of a, shall we say, complicated. But I think what a lot of people did was they despite the flaws, they wanted him to carry out this very big job. So a lot of people, sort of in spite of, they hoped he would be successful. And I suppose that's what I felt, you know, begrudgingly, I accepted that he would become prime minister. And so I've been disappointed, truly disappointed. I thought he would rise to the occasion. And a couple of interesting pieces about him recently, one of which said that actually, we know he loves to be loved, and that he actually could never say no to people. And some of his downfall was that he wasn't ruthless enough. You know, he let Dominic Cummings in a way, and the whole Kerry thing, take up a lot of his time in number 10, I think obscured a lot of things. If he'd sacked Cummings after Durham, if he had been stricter about Partygate, and at the very final thing that brought him down was the pincher there. You know, everybody at Westminster knew this. I don't want to sort of make allegations, but you know that there were problems around his character. And if only Boris had stood up and said yes, and he has to go, he'd still be here, actually. Although I think people still want to bring him down.
Yes, I mean, I think it all dates back to the Owen Paterson affair, actually. But yes, that has a similar flavour to it in terms of personal loyalty.
Yes,
and I think my sense of one of the reasons why Boris was so appealing to as many people as he was because he has that deeply human ability to make connections with, I was going to say, flawed people, damaged people. We're all flawed and damaged in some way, to some degree. But there's something about him that really connects with people in that way. And I've been very conscious of a massive amount of work that he had done around mental health, for example. I think he found that a really important topic and would have loved to have done more around that, because I think he'd experienced
a traumatic childhood.
And he'd had such a chaotic childhood. So he was never really going to be the uber parent, because he'd always had to be the uber child, really, to cope with that. And that's why one of my questions to you was going to be, do you think he has a legacy that is worth celebrating? Because I do think that, and it seems to be rather unfashionable at the moment.
Yes, I do. I think that whoever had taken on the task of Brexit, well, we know because Theresa May tried it, the Northern Ireland Protocol, and he would have to fight the left of his own party and the very strong left Remainer element of the media, who hated him and they still hate him. So he had sort of huge constituencies that he had to fight. But as the man who had promised it, you know, he was never going to win it. And there would always have to be compromise. And it's a pity he couldn't, particularly on Northern Ireland, I think. I think that's the sad bit of the story. And then, of course, the COVID lockdown came in. And I think he was trapped by many forces, that his instinct is to be a libertarian. And we know in those first few weeks when people were locking down and calling on him, it's, I think, fairly obvious that he did not feel that that was the right approach. And if you remember, it was Patrick Vallance who talked about herd immunity. And once that herd immunity, that expression, came into the media ether, if you like, it meant you're going to let everybody die. It meant you're going to be a mass killer. And he realized he couldn't fight that. I mean, I don't know enough of what went in. I'd love to know those talks, but clearly he was pushed. And Dominic Cummings, as we now know, was a big lockdown man, contrary to what everybody thought at the time.
Yeah.
He was pro-lockdown. So I think, again, he was sort of caught by these different constituencies and whether lockdown in those first few months. I don't think it was too late. I don't think much would have been different if we'd done it too soon.
Although, as someone who knew a group of people who went to Cheltenham about a week before, was astonishing, and there were phone calls in our household with people saying, "Do you really want to go?" And other people saying, "I really do want to go." And you only have to look at that Christmas lockdown that didn't happen. So that one from last year, that to me was Boris being Boris, absolutely resisting
that was his instinct,
another Christmas lockdown. And that would be, for me, one of the things that I would celebrate. But I agree with you. I think his instincts were to try to encourage people to use their initiative and to use their common sense. And in fact, I think there is quite a well-known statistic about some figures that came out of Google research that showed that instinctively people were already making choices, having watched on the television what was happening in Wuhan and in Milan.
People are not stupid, actually. And I think the British, we like to queue, we like to ration, we like to stockpile. We still have this sort of semi-war mentality. No, we do. I mean, remember the loo roll thing? Do you remember?
That was extraordinary.
Did
you know that it was different in different countries? So in America, it was powdered milk. And in the UK, it was toilet roll. Yes. So I'm quite, again, from a Freudian point of view,
I wrote a big piece at the time, Lucy, and you're right, we had one of the highest percentages of use of toilet roll in the world.
Yeah,
we do. Because obviously in Europe, they use water more often. And a lot of people think, actually, certainly Middle East think that toilet roll is incredibly unhygienic. It's very, very funny. But no, I remember traveling to London on March the 14th, because it's my son's birthday. And we all talked that day. We were all going to congregate in London. And so we were all saying, well, should we meet up? You know, it was in the psyche already, as you say. We knew we were taking risks. And then the other legacy, I will just mention, not because we weren't in the EU, actually. I don't think that was the issue. But his call to Kate Bingham to appoint her was a genius. I mean, she's a brilliant woman, and she really put a rocket under everything. So I think in the vaccine point of view, that would be part of his legacy too.
Yes, because I think, you know, people are very quick to say, oh, yes, but what about Dr. Sarah Gilbert? And absolutely, the people who made the vaccine, they are astonishing. But Boris and Kate in particular really harnessed a lot of talent, made cross-pollination of information happen much more quickly. They made funding available, and they basically approached people like AstraZeneca and said, well, you know, can you do it? Can you do it at cost? And those conversations weren't happening in other countries. So definitely Boris's legacy is worth celebrating on to some degree. Do you think he'll come back, actually?
Churchill did. He likes to mirror himself. No, I don't think he will, actually, weirdly enough.
I don't know
what it would be as. It wouldn't be as Prime Minister. Maybe some sort of other institutional national role. No, I don't think as a politician. I think this has probably damaged him.
Certainly the manner of his departure, I think, has really affected him, because he feels
I think it has.
Very let down. And that came out in his closing speech when he was talking about the rules having been changed. It turned out to be a relay race and the rules were changed halfway through, which of course then brings me to Liz Truss and the fact that she made a speech obviously later that day. And there are so many, I mean, she's only been in power for 3 days, but already there's a lot to unpick. And I wondered, given the nature of Boris's tenure, was there a sense that her speech, which was very short and very focused, you know, I've got three things that I'm going to focus on. I'm going to focus on tax cuts. I'm going to focus on energy. I'm going to focus on the NHS. How important was it that a very dramatic shift in tone was apparent just even in those two speeches?
I think it was very important. There's been a lot of criticism how flat and dull, and she used deliver, deliver, deliver. That was in the acceptance speech, wasn't it? And that she is almost not fluent, and she said herself that she's not a slick performer. And that in itself has its own charm. I think she's quite steadfast, is a word I would use about her. We know she changes her opinions, and clever people do. When the facts change, you change. She's gone from no handouts to the biggest handout just a few minutes ago in British history. And I think, not that she's dull, but I think she's earnest and serious, almost sort of head girlish, but not in that Theresa May way.
Yeah, she's the naughty head girl in a way. You can imagine.
She's the naughty head girl, yeah.
She would allow you to have, you know,
smoke a hand cigarette and smoke a hand checks. You know? She probably would tick you off rather than report to you.
That's right. She'd have a quick drag herself and then say, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's right. I think there's a steadfastness about her. And I wondered, there's been a lot of focus on this policy that has been announced just, you know, a few minutes before we start recording. But I actually wonder how important the policy was, or whether this is more about what people really need is to see that she's being truthful and to see that she's being authentic, as opposed to what they imagine we had before. That actually it isn't so much about the policy, although that matters in many ways. I went to an incredible reception on Monday night, and the head of Rio Tinto said, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast, which is this fantastic kind of corporate speech.
Yeah.
But I thought a similar thing happens in politics, because politics is very much about storytelling, isn't it?
It's about all about stories.
We tell ourselves, and it's about the stories that politicians tell us about themselves and about their policies. So what did you make maybe of the policy? Is it less about the policy that's just...
I think it's less about the policy. I mean, if you could just step back a little bit, the big debate between Rishi and her during the hustings was, he was saying, we've got to stick to the current policy, there's no money tree, we can't, you know, I can't bring back the corporation tax in next year, we can't abolish it, for sure. It's all negative, it was all just stay boring the same. And that way was heading downhill. She was radical, she was bold, she was saying, actually, we need to gamble, we need to give the confidence back. And even if some of the numbers don't add up, you know, there's a way of doing it. You can actually roll this over many, many years. And the funding of this programme will be key. And I haven't seen yet how they're proposing that. What I felt gave, and she used the word aspirational, but not in that sort of Osborne patronising way. I think she has the sense of the working person, and that she's giving back after this hullabaloo. Might have been fun at times with Boris, but actually a purpose, and we're going to look after you. And I think Britain likes female leaders. I loathe debate about it, you know, and I thought Theresa May made a mistake yesterday to say about the third female. For God's sake, aren't we, you know, we've gone beyond that. Mm. But if you think Queen Elizabeth, Victoria, the current Queen, Margaret Thatcher, not in the Merkel Mutti sense, but maybe a little bit, actually. I think we quite like that feminine feel. And she doesn't overdo the whole feminine thing either. So I think it's confidence, and people, quite simply, are facing, and I've seen it in our household and friends and relatives, you know, a doubling, if not tripling, of energy bills. People simply, you know, it will put, I think, a third of people into what was called fuel poverty. It is a big thing. So in a sense, she had to cut the hydra, she had to cut the head. She had to say, this is how we're doing it. and to do it over 2 years, people can go, poof, okay, so I don't need to, if you're a small pub, you don't have to close. Or if you're a brewer, I was talking to a brewer in Norfolk 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, whose bill had gone from 11,000 a year to 40,000. He said, you know, I don't want a handout. He was very honest, said, but it means I won't employ another person. It means I won't get a bit more machinery. And so the whole economy suffers the ripple effect. So I think what she is bringing is a level of security and how we fund it.
And the security, interestingly enough, about that word security, and sort of to reference back to your comment about Britain liking female leaders, I wouldn't put Theresa May in that camp, actually. And the reason for that is that I think it's not so much that Britain likes female leaders. It's just that the female leaders we've had have been very coherent and very steadfast, to go back to your word, Liz. The comment that is often made about Margaret Thatcher is that even if you didn't like her, at least you knew where she stood. And that, you know, the lady's not for turning. But as you say, if bright people, smart people do change their mind when the facts change. And we will see that, I think, with Liz Truss. But I think it's more that sense of competence. And don't forget, the electorate, we always infantilize ourselves. We vote, and that's our sense of power. But ultimately, we are voting to do ourselves out of power, to be able to say, okay, we're now voting you in. You're the people who are running the
show.
You
can take on.
And we need to trust you. We need to trust that you're going to look after us. That's our contract. That's the unspoken contract between the electorate and the politicians. And for that to happen, you need to feel that, like your parents, hopefully they're going to be boundaried and they're going to be reliable and they're going to not let you down. And that's,
and judgments. Make good judgments. Yeah. There's something else about Liz Truss, and it's quite funny. I love the Oxford snobbery, but I was talking to an Oxford professor earlier this week, and he asked me what I thought about Truss, and we chatted. He said, you know, there's one thing. You know, she got into Merton, and Merton is probably the most intellectual, most difficult of all the Oxford colleges. It is seen to be, you know, intellectually really rigorous. And he said, and you know, Rishi, he only got into Lincoln. I know it. I just loved it. She did, or somebody else gave, she did study mathematical logic. You know, she has got a very crisp brain. Clearly, you don't do mathematical logic. And I'm not saying, you know, clever people are not always wise people in terms of politics. But I think that goes back to changing her mind so she can look at the numbers, she'll look and work out what is sensible, which is why when people say, oh, they're gambling, I don't think she's a gambler. I think she thinks big. She sees what is wrong. And you know, the British economy of the last few years, and Boris's attitude to business, no one ever knew, you know, from that famous F business that he is supposed to have told a group of people. A business community didn't feel they were part of what was going on. I think she's talked so much about growth and dynamics. And I mean, what she needs to do is sort of big enterprise zones. She needs to keep the big picture thinking up. The danger is that when you get into the Treasury, and she's worked there before, you know, the groupthink of the Treasury stops you from doing things. And I think that would be her big fight. It would be being brave enough to push through.
And also she has two other constituencies really that she needs to think about. The polling this week was very clear that fewer than half of British people reckon they would recognise her if they walked past her in the street. And I wonder, given that she's been on Instagram for as long as she has, not that Instagram is real life.
That shows you the Brits.
But, you know, that's an extraordinary thing. To have been at trade, to have been foreign secretary, and for lots of people who, let's face it, the majority of people aren't a political animal. They're not that interested in politics. So they don't really know what she's like, who she is.
But that's to her advantage, isn't it, Lucy? Don't you think? She doesn't come with a caricature. She doesn't come with, oh, terrible personal life, or she's not very bad. She can now hopefully create or show us the nature of her personality. And she's done that already. Mm.
And therefore, do you think that will be harder? Because one of the things that obviously Labour have hoped for, perhaps, is to have a leader where one of their attack lines could be, oh, this is just more of the same. You know, this is Boris in a dress. This is somebody who's been in Boris's cabinet throughout. In fact, she was in David Cameron's cabinet. So how come this is change? But actually, given that so few people know her, that she is a blank screen,
Yeah.
Which, you know, in a Freudian way, we can all project onto her whatever we want. That, as you say, that might be a strength for her.
Yeah, absolutely. So she can build it and create it. And people can't remember the sort of gaffes. So there's only Westminster MPs who remember all the pictures of her with all the flags when she did the trade deals. But yeah, and also I think for Labour, she's going to be quite tricky to deal with because she is a Northern comprehensive, might have been a good comprehensive, educated girl whose father was very left-wing by all accounts and wouldn't vote for her from what we hear. A maths professor and her mother, I believe, a nurse carer. And so she had this back, her backstory, and we talked about everyone has to tell a story. Actually, she can, that backstory is quite powerful, isn't it? She went on CND marches. She used to be a Republican, but in a sense, there's a strength in that. I mean, I hate to admit it, you know, I think I had a period of being a Republican too, but at least then you saw the arguments and you've argued with yourself and you've come to a different opinion through experience. So when people go, oh, she's gone from Lib Dem and she was a Republican, she remained, to my mind, they are strengths that she can play to because she's grown up, she's looked at the arguments.
And the gap, let's face it, between Labour and the Conservatives now is really, really massive. The polling gap, the voting intention gap, the assessment of who would be, which party would be more competent on the economy, which leader would be more trusted by the public. All of those polling figures have been probably quite nerve-wracking for Conservative Party HQ. What do you think Truss needs to do to close that gap with Labour?
Ignore it. Completely ignore it and just get on with what she's doing. Just show, not tell. You know, don't talk about diversity. I'm very pleased that she dropped the women from the Ministry of Equality. So that's a really good, that was such a patronising thing. I know people get a scream through murder, but yeah, just get on with it, actually, not get on with the job in that, you know, silly way, but actually show that she means, because she made a very good point, we'll try and solve the current energy price, but what we're going to do is overturn 30 years, and half of which were Conservative governments, and they must take the blame, as well as Labour, of not planning Britain's security of supply. Yeah. And she's done that already with the oil and gas. Now, you can argue about whether it's green or not. That's not really the point right now. We have to build some sort of self-sufficiency into our supplies. And actually, the other legacy of Boris is getting nuclear going. You know, that was actually quite a big thing. He really did spearhead that earlier in the year. So ignore it. Just keep doing what she's doing. Don't play their game. Don't fall into it.
Yes, and perhaps we saw a little bit of that at her performance in Prime Minister's questions yesterday, that if she was asked a question, she just answered it. There was no sense of bluster, no sense of trying to play a game. Yeah. And maybe that clarity will be something that will play well with the public again, that doesn't like to feel that people are taking it all as a big joke and it's all just about words, that actually people think, oh, that our lives are at stake here, our livelihoods are at stake here.
Yeah. So, and she really cares about it.
What did you think of her performance at PMQs?
I thought it was really good. I thought the best line was the North London, if you wanted to do identity politics. That was very quick. And it clearly had come to her very quickly, hadn't it? She just delivered it well. I thought she was much more relaxed than her previous speeches. And maybe she will, you know, you grow into the role, not too confident. I don't think, you know, she doesn't want to seem satisfied, does she? She's got to be, just keep very straight, steadfast. Deliver, if I dare use the word. And Theresa Coffey, I mean, what a brilliant appointment at Health. We haven't mentioned her.
Yes.
Another brainy woman.
Forensic brain and someone who really likes to be across the detail, which is what she was at Work and Pensions.
Yeah.
And someone who comes across as having quite a lot of empathy as well.
Yeah.
And also, you know, a supremely bright Chancellor in Kwasi Kwarteng.
Absolutely, historian. He won a scholarship to Eton, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Then Cambridge, and then a scholarship to Harvard, and then several books. Quiet man. So this could be interesting to see what they do.
Yes, it could be a really intellectually heavyweight experience. And I'm sure there are critics. There always are critics. But it would be certainly from a human point of view, we just all want them to do well because it's our lives as well.
This is not party politics right now. You've got Putin, who is not giving up on Ukraine, you know, could stop all gas. Well, Nord Stream has closed down, basically, threatening to keep it closed unless sanctions are lifted. We're in a very precarious, we've sort of forgotten about it in a sense.
Yes, and I think it's quite useful, don't you think, that given that she was foreign secretary in her previous role, she's already met Sergei Lavrov, that actually she has stepped into that world and tried to understand them and tried to understand their psychological warfare as much as their actual military warfare. So that I think...
Yeah, and she had a very sticky meeting with him where he was very rude to her because she got, actually, I think, one of the geographic names of the oblasts wrong. And I think she actually did get it wrong. He was very rude. But I don't know if you remember, in one of the hustings, it might have been the first one, where Rishi Sunak did all that interruption stuff, one of the questions to the candidate was, would you go and negotiate directly with Putin? And I think she was the only one who said, yeah, absolutely, I would go and meet him tomorrow, type thing. And I was sort of wondering, you know how sometimes, you know, it took Tony Blair to reform Clause 4, it took Charles de Gaulle to liberate Algeria. Sometimes it's the foes that are able to, the enemies that are able to get together. Who knows, maybe she can. Maybe I'm being too optimistic. I'm often accused of being too optimistic.
Well, I don't think optimism is a bad thing. I'd much rather be a glass half full person than not. But yes, in the same way as I rather hoped that Boris Johnson's first day as Prime Minister would have seen him heading to Tehran to see if he could get Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe out. I do wonder whether Liz Truss's first foreign visit ought to be something really dramatic.
Yeah, like somewhere, maybe Istanbul, you know, because Turkey's obviously played quite a role in mediating two sides. Maybe Erdogan could host a mediation.
Well, Liz Truss, if you're listening, that's our advice. But for now, Maggie Pagano, editor at Reaction, really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much for being on the couch.
Thank you.